WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Nashville is a community in mourning, losing six to a mass shooting at a Christian school Monday.
I'm grateful for the resilience of this city, and I have no doubt that we will stay strong and get through this together.
Reverend Clay Stauffer with Woodmont Christian Church speaking at a Nashville vigil featuring local and state officials calling for healing. House Democrats demanding gun legislation after the mass shooting. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries.
We're demanding that Congress act, because the level of gun violence in this country is unacceptable, it's unconscionable, and it's un-American.
But Governor Bill Lee says now is the time for prayers. Outgoing Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz insisting to a Senate committee that the coffee chain has not broken labor laws and is willing to bargain with workers who voted to unionize. This is ABC News. Norfolk Southern agreeing to exclusively use Ohio-based businesses to clean the site of the toxic derailment in East Palestine. That cleanup could take 2 years. One European city is warning off British men.
Online ads targeting British men between the ages of 18 to 35, urging them to behave in Amsterdam or stay home. Warning that a long weekend in the city may create the wrong kind of memories and that the escapism tourists crave could result in arrest and jail time. The initiative forms part of efforts to clean up Amsterdam's raunchy reputation as Europe's most liberal party capital. Critics argue the targeted ad campaigns are discriminatory and based on unfair stereotypes. Inez de la Quatera, ABC News.
Macy says Chairman and CEO Jeff Gennett plans to retire and will be succeeded by Bloomingdale's Chair and CEO Tony Spring in February. Gennett has served as Macy's CEO since March of 2017, became Chairman in February of 2018. Spring becomes President and CEO-elect of Macy's. Andy Field, ABC News.
Oh, now, wait until you pull up to the stop and go light, but when you do, go ahead and save the Civic Media Station to one of your presets. The Cripes Cast with me, Charlie Behrens, and also on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Wisconsin-based interest groups are making their endorsements in the race for state Supreme Court.
The Dairy Business Association, a dairy lobby group, and NFIB Wisconsin PAC endorsed former Justice Daniel Kelly. The small business advocacy organization said Kelly will provide a predictable legal climate for small businesses. I'm Melissa Kay for Civic Media News.
Meanwhile, 300 Wisconsin doctors have signed a letter supporting Janet Protasiewicz. When it comes to fundraising, Protasiewicz has raised more than five times as much money as Kelly. She raised almost $12.5 million in the final campaign finance reporting period. Kelly raised a little more than $2 million at the same time. In sports, Wisconsin's basketball season is over after last night's loss in the NIT semifinals. Tonight, the Bucks are at Indiana. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Dear hero, whoever you are, you save lives. I live with sickle cell and the pain and the issues that come along with sickle cell every day. I've had lots and lots of blood transfusions over my lifetime, probably in the hundreds. Blood helps me to be able to live.
My final tour was in Afghanistan in 2008. I was hit June 3rd. The next thing I remember, I woke up in Germany. The doctor came in and said, we're gonna amputate your leg. I had to get a lot of blood transfusion to stay alive.
Because of you, I'm allowed to see my son grow up.
Because of you, I got a second chance at life.
Giving equals living. Give blood, replenish the supply. Make an appointment to give today by visiting hhs.gov/giveblood. This message is brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold. 1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003. 125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football. You're about to find out. Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Saturday and Sunday at 1 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
Hey, son, how are you feeling? I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Moving Day, a walk for Parkinson's, is happening around the country. Together we can unite in the fight against Parkinson's disease in a safe but exciting and fun way. So let's get moving. Join the Parkinson's Foundation to learn more and register at movingdaywalk.org.
Do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So recently, Fox News breathlessly was reporting that Russia evidently is going to start using the yuan for trade, and that China has been organizing to make a move to make the yuan the global currency. And they brought on this Monica Crowley, who was an assistant secretary of public affairs with the U.S. Department of Treasury. And, you know, her response of this idea that, you know, the yuan is going to go and be, you know, replace the dollar. This, oh my God, the end of humanity. It's the end of the country. It's the end of humanity. And it's all because of the perfect storm. And this is her words: Biden's weakness, Biden's war on U.S. energy, Biden's handling of Ukraine, and this new economic bloc that isn't new. We've been talking about the BRIC countries for a long time. But I'm going, you know, is she right? If the dollar is no longer the reserve currency for everyone, do we have massive inflation like the Weimar Republic? I mean, is it the end of humanity? Well, that's why I'm going to an expert. I've asked my good friend Mateus Vernango to come share some thoughts with us. He's an economics professor at Bucknell University. He does the fabulous blog nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com. Check out stuff there. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rick.
So let's start with the simple question. You got Monica Crowley saying that if the dollar is replaced because, I guess, Russia's going to start using yuans to deal with China, it's the end of humanity. It's all over. The dollar is dead. The U.S. economy's shot. We're all going to be living on a street corner begging for pencils.
Well, you know, first of all, even if Russia is using the yuan, even if you give them more than Russia, you know, more than a few countries because of this, you know, sort of that are closer to China and to their sort of, you know, in Africa and in some other developing regions start using a little bit more the yuan, you know, the chances of U.S. dollar not being the key currency in the near future, you know, I'm not even, are, you know, negligible. It's not something that can happen. But, you know, let's say that the yuan increases a little bit. There is no chance that anything significant will happen. This is pure hysteria. So there is no basis for this sort of, you know, fear. And the most basic, you know, measure that you have of this is that China, so let's say that, you know, China is holding $3.5 trillion in their bank. And the Bank of China, the People's Bank of China. So China needs dollars, whereas the United States holds no amount of yuan at the Fed, and for good reason. So the yuan is 3% perhaps of central bank reserves around the globe, and the dollar has been since the 70s about 60%. 30% is basically the euro, and before that it was a mix of, anyways, the franc and the Deutsche Mark. So things have not changed. Those things change slowly. there's no reason to think that there is anything in the near future that will change. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is that inflation has nothing to do with, you know, with actually the position of the dollar and those things. So the inflation that we have had more recently has to do a little bit with the war, but it has to do exactly with the fact of the price of oil, because of this sort of issues and the pandemic and supply chain issues and corporations and whatnot, that the cost side of prices have gone up. That has nothing to do with the position of the dollar in international markets.
Now, the scenario that she focused on was Saudi Arabia was going to start taking the Chinese yuan, and that, if we had to start buying it, this hyperinflation and gas prices would go through the roof. What are the chances of that happening? I mean, because I've had some people go, well, what if it does happen? I go, I actually don't know.
So Saudi Arabia has had talked of accepting a certain amount of payments in yuan, and that's perfectly fine. So, I mean, I don't think that, first of all, I don't think that international markets will stop pricing oil in dollars. Again, if they use a little bit more, what is the difference if they, let's say that there is a significant increase, large increase in the use of yuan. We go from 3% in the reserves to, perhaps 10% in a few years. And invoicing, the U.S. invoices all of its exports and imports in dollars. Not the case for most other countries. So even other developing countries, a good chunk of their trade is done in dollars. So if China is trading with Russia, that's what it's changing. If China traded with Russia before, they did it in dollars. So they're going to try to reduce the use of dollars because Russia has a huge embargo and doesn't have dollars. And they're going to trade directly in yuan. And so sure, that will increase a little bit, the use of yuan in international transactions and reduce a little bit, the use of the dollar. How significant is that? Not much. Nothing changes very much for the United States. I think in terms of changes that, are important and that we should be sort of interested in what will happen ahead of us is that there is an increase in pressure from the U.S. to move away things from China. So we are concerned since the pandemic, but I think even before, with having significant amount of our supply chains tied to China. So there is talk of, for example, the iPhones moving away from being all done in China and perhaps more in India and so on and so forth. They're not coming back, they're not coming to the U.S. So that's the part that should be concerned. So the CHIPS program that, Biden has, passed through Congress last year, $50 billion and whatnot. That would bring some manufacturing jobs to the U.S. But most of these other jobs will go to India, to Vietnam, to other countries in Asia.
Right.
And so that, will have some sort of impact, but, not the sorts of impacts that, Ms. Crawley was suggesting. And so it's not inflation. It's not it's a move away from the China dominated trade that we have had over the last 20 something years, which has affected us significantly. So when you look at the history of manufacturing jobs in the United States, I always say to my students, when you look at this stuff, manufacturing jobs were more or less around 17, 18 million manufacturing jobs from the late 60s until the early 2000s. So NAFTA didn't do much for that. No other free trade agreement. It's the moment that China entered the WTO that we lost about 5 million manufacturing jobs.
Right.
So I'm sorry to say, I don't think those are coming back. But the notion that, what they got is, at that point, cheap labor, and those things are changing in China. It's not as cheap as before. They do have networks of production that are very important, and so that's why it's very hard to move away from China. And that gives them some leverage in being able to negotiate in certain parts with yuan. There might be an increase in the use of the yuan. China has become more important, but that's not the end of the world, and it's not even the end of the dollar as a key currency. So all of those things are very confused. And also, she said in that sort of clip at Fox News that it was the printing of money, in the U.S. that caused this. But, we've been printing money for a long time in huge amounts, with the 2008-09 crisis, that was the result of a big bubble, during the Bush era. And, you know, nothing happened. We had no inflation. So the notion that the printing of money is causing inflation is also a significant confusion, you know, from you know. And she should know better. She worked at the Treasury, so she should know.
No, she shouldn't.
She plagiarized her thesis. So.
Well, there is that. But here's the thing. As I was watching it, and I watched it a couple of times, you know, this kind of hair on fire, it's what I expect from Fox News. It's the misinformation, it's the outrage candy, it's all of this. What I took from it is, okay, you know, China's bailing out Russia, and you know, Russia's economy's struggling. We've got this embargo, all trade's done in dollars, so China's bailing them out, and they're creating a partnership, basically, you know, setting up this kind of bipolar thing. Saw.
They don't have the capacity to completely bail out Russia. What they're doing, Russia is what? It's an economy that has an old-fashioned but, you know, still productive military industrial complex. They do have that, and they produce a lot of oil. So they're a very large Venezuela. And China is diversified. It is, you know, an industrial, you know, sort of powerhouse. They produce more manufacturing goods than us, you know, these days. So that's certainly true. But on the other hand, you know, I always say, you know, think of this. How many Chinese kids are studying here, and how many American kids are studying there? Think of how many stories we have of industrial espionage, that, you know, of Chinese scientists that are caught here passing information, and how many we have that are vice versa. How many American companies are there producing and transferring technology and not happening here? So, and that suggests to me that while it's true that China moved very fast and in certain sectors is challenging U.S. dominance, it is still the case that, you know, they are trying to catch up and they are trying to get some of the technology and getting their kids in our universities and so on and so forth to catch up. So the notion that this is a done deal and we're already living in a Chinese world is again, part of this exaggeration. And I would say it's also dangerous to paint this as a rivalry that, you know, we have to necessarily be xenophobic and afraid the Chinese are trying to destroy us. So, you know, there is a heightened rhetoric, in particular with the Republican Party on this topic, that I think it's dangerous. So, you know, yes, there are challenges. There are challenges in American, you know, hegemony in several sectors. But I don't think we should take this, you know, like it's a new Cold War. I don't think we are, you know, in that stage. And so I think it's dangerous also to play with that kind of rhetoric.
Yeah, well, listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Matthias Vernangel, professor of economics at Bucknell University. Check out his website, nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com. We'll get links out on social media. The BRIC countries came up again, and this has been something that's been going on for at least a decade, where they've been talking about cooperation and having a common currency. This is all old news. But again, it does a nice job of fear-mongering, I think.
Yeah, well, they never, there's no plan for a common currency. So what they do have is a bank, the Bank of the BRICS, you know, that has the New Development Bank or whatever it's called now, but it was called the Bank of the BRICS. In fact, the new president is the ex-president of Brazil. So Dilma Rousseff, it's going to be the new president of the Bank of the BRICS. And, you know, and it is just a development bank. So what if they are a rival of anything is of the World Bank. So they're going to give money for big projects of development in countries that to some extent have more relations with China than with the U.S. And, you know, and that certainly is, you know, something that will or might expand the role of the yuan globally. Again, from a very low base. So these are not things that, you know, necessarily. Look, right after the Second World War, 50% of the global manufacturing was in the U.S.
Right.
So the notion that that could be sustainable and the U.S. could produce 50% of the global manufacturing with 5% of the population, it's untenable. So China, it's, you know, 1.2, 1.3, whatever, you know, billion people. So it's obvious that they're going to have a large sort of impact in what happens in the world economy and that their economy will have a larger sort of, you know, role and hence their currency. So that's not the end of the world. And there are many ways in which we can cooperate with China and in other things, not so much. So, you know, like with any sort of relationship, you have to be careful about certain things. You have to cooperate on other things and so on and so forth. So Some will, you know, further American interests. And what American interests? When we talk about American, we shouldn't be talking about as if we're a monolithic country in which we all have the same interests. You know, the working class in this country has different interests than parts of the elite in this country. So there are part corporations that are there in China that benefit from certain things that, you know, they benefited from the fact that we lost 5 million manufacturing jobs and that they could sort of outsource a lot of those jobs to, you know, cheaper labor force. So it's not that everything that China does hurts the American working class. And so we should take that into consideration when we think about free trade agreements and, you know, and reorganizing this kind of geopolitics of trade and currency, you know, who is being hurt within the United States? So we are not all in the on the same boat. I think that's an important element in all of this.
Excellent point. Last question I've got for you, because at the end of her clip, she spins towards once the dollar goes down because of this, and she's already assumed the dollar is going to die because, you know, the Russians and the Chinese are trading in yuan. Then she said, the digital currency's coming, and then you're going to lose your freedom. I'm not a fan of digital currencies. I don't want to see us go to a digital currency. But again, a nice bit of fear-mongering at the end of a whole bunch of fear-mongering.
Oh, but that won't happen. I mean, there is no reason. So you can go to my blog in 2011. So that's how old that is. You know, I'm saying that Bitcoin is a bubble, and it is a bubble, and this currency. So digital currencies make the Fed may make the dollar a digital currency. So, but it will be the dollar. So it won't be a private currency. So Bitcoin and all of those things are just are funny money, and they're done just to rob people, as they did. You know, this, you know, Bankman Friedman, I don't know, guy, you know, that was caught, you know, so all of this stuff is not significant, and I don't think there is any reason to fear digital currencies as becoming the future of global currency. So I don't think that's an issue.
There you go, Mateus. I appreciate the input, as always, good stuff.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate your time, our good friend Mateus Vernango. Make sure you check out his website, nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I saw Tommy Tuberville trending on Twitter, and I'm like, oh, geez. What kind of stupidity can be coming out of the dumbest guy in the Senate's mouth today? Evidently, though, the Alabama Republican has decided that he's going to block all Department of Defense promotions and nominations over the abortion issue. So if you're in the military right now, you're getting nothing thanks to the dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate, all because of, his opposition to abortion. And again, this is, remember when they said, you know, we just want to make it, you know, we're not going to do all of the other stuff that they're saying we're going to do. Yeah. Some good news coming out of Florida. Evidently, Matt Gaetz feeling a little emboldened by the fact that he's not going to be indicted for the crimes that he was accused of. He has hired a convicted war criminal as a staff member in his office, a guy named Derek Miller, a former U.S. Army National Guard sergeant who spent 8 years in prison for murdering Afghan citizens. And, you know, again, this is that we're going to shove it in your face, you know, and military be damned. We're going to ram this down your throat. You know, we're just in such a weird kind of place. And, you know, I was watching some of the social media comments on this. And again, predictably, it's, you know, on, you know, whichever hat you're wearing, a red hat or a blue hat, with, you know, Republicans defending him. And I'm going, I don't know. I think just murdering people who aren't part of the military plan, aren't part of the actual battle. I don't know. I don't think that's something we should be doing. I think we should be better than that. But, you know, look, social media is full of stories of people, you know, doing crazy stuff that I don't agree with. Which is why I came across this article. I think it was over at The Atlantic. The story of this guy who lost a child. And, you know, he goes into, the kid evidently fell, had an accident at home. He called it a household accident brought on by a rare cerebral swelling. So by the time the paramedics got there to revive the kid, the brain just didn't start. And, you know, sadly, the kid passed. And immediately the internet, immediately Twitter, immediately social media cesspool went after them under, you know, again, by division. You know, this is what you get for vaccinating your child. And from what he said, look, you know, it was just horrible. It was constant. It was just in every direction, some of the most vile comments. You know, this is your fault. Yeah, it's murder in the first. You got the jab, right? You deserve this. This kind of stuff that, you know, you see people who are on these social media sites being the worst versions of themselves. And, you know, he said, look, you know, I never imagined that anyone would mock or terrorize grieving parents. And you go, hey, did you not pay attention to all of the people, the families in Sandy Hook, who, the Alex Jones crowd went after, or any of these shootings that, you know, the right wing spins to, oh, those are false flags. That didn't really happen. Those are crisis actors. And it was all around this thing that, you know, he got his kids vaccinated. He got himself vaccinated. And now they're taking the tragedy of this kid dying and, you know, just going after these people. And, you know, just in a horrible way. And they, they put out an obituary with the kid's picture in it. And people on social media took the picture and wrote all kinds of horrible, horrible, destructive things. And you come back from this and you go, I'm in this weird world right now, because I can't imagine anyone doing that. I can't imagine what kind of person would do this. I guess the same kind of person who would walk into a school and shoot a helpless 9-year-old. I can't imagine what goes through somebody's head that they would go and murder a child, or, you know, go after the parents of that child. You know, what is it about us that has gotten us to this point? And I keep coming back to the media culture that's out there. It's all about the outrage. It's all about spewing what you want to be reality. There are no more facts anymore. It's all alternative facts. And you talk to, you know, red hat or blue hat, and they've got their line down, and discussions can't be had. You know, and look, I've given up on talking to the fives. You know, in organizing speak, a five is unreachable. Don't even waste your time. And I get some of those folks occasionally who will just, you know, they'll just blare out every right-wing talking point that Fox News throws out. And we know Fox News is in the business of entertaining. They need to keep you outraged, to keep you in the seat, to keep your eyes glued to the set. It's kind of like when, you know, have you ever seen the Howard Stern movie where there's a scene in there where the station manager's reading out the numbers, and, you know, people who love Stern watch for this, you know, listen for this long a time, and the people who hate him, you know, listen for twice as long because they want to know what kind of craziness is going to come next. The F channel people, they've figured this out. They've got people who want to know what's next, who want to know what the anger is, so they can keep feeding them that, so they can profit off of them. And whether our country, you know, suffers for it, whether people struggle and are attacked, that doesn't matter to them, because it's all, as Rupert Murdoch said, it's not about red or blue. It's about green. Sad state of affairs. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1948. That was the day that the labor movement came literally to the doorstep of Wall Street. The United Financial Employees Union went out on strike. The union was started in 1941 by Merritt David Keefe, a page who had worked on the stock exchange trading floor. Keefe had grown up too poor to finish high school. He had gone to Wall Street in the hope of finding wealth and financial security. Instead, he found long hours and low-paying work. He decided the only way to change things was to form a union. By 1946, the union had grown to 5,000 members. Keefe described their platform, calling for a general overall minimum increase of 25% in the salaries of Wall Street employees, job security, benefits of a pension fund, and, in addition, a bonus computed on the volume of trading. Negotiations drug on. Finally, 1,100 union members walked out on strike against both the New York Stock Exchange and the New York Curb Exchange. 500 members of the Seafarers Union supported the exchange workers' cause. The first day of the strike was peaceful, but the next morning, the police told the strikers they could not picket the main entrance of the stock exchange. One 19-year-old woman refused to go across the street. The police reacted by grabbing her and arresting her. Outraged, the picketers rushed to her aid. Some attempted to lie down in the entrance to block the exchange. The police wielded batons, hospitalizing two strikers and arresting more than 40. Sadly, the strike ended in defeat in April, as 100 workers lost their jobs because of their involvement. The workers had lost the Battle of Wall Street, the first and only strike at the exchange. Gotta be cool on Wall Street. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Until recently, kids were thrilled when their parents said, "We're going to Disney World." But that was in the before times, before Florida's autocratic governor put Disney World under the control of his state's thought police, turning it into DeSantis World. Having made kid-friendly Disney kowtow to his own magic kingdom of right-wing ideological conformity, Governor Ron is now demanding that the entire Sunshine State convert to the darkness of DeSantis World. A major tactic in his push is to rewrite the state's school books to, quote, protect young ones from having to learn that such historical unpleasantness as racism and sexism have shaped their society and are still doing so. To advance Ron Think, he has rammed his Stop Woke Act into law, requiring teachers to soften or just eliminate references to America's racial problems. Pretend it never happened is Professor DeSantis' instruction. Indeed, one educational publisher obediently followed his dictate by rewriting the uplifting 1955 story of Rosa Parks confronting the flagrant institutional racism of Montgomery, Alabama's public bus service. Before DeSantis, the publisher told the story straight. Quote, "In her city, the law said African Americans had to give up their seats if a white person wanted to sit down. Parks would not give up her seat. The police came and took her to jail." Now, after desantification, here's the publisher's rewrite. One day, Parks rode the bus. She was told to move to a different seat. She did not. She did what she believed was right. No reference to her even being African American or to the law requiring her to bow to any white person's demand for her seat. And no mention of police hauling her to jail because of the color of her skin. This is Jim Hightower saying, DeSantis World is where people's dream of social justice goes to die.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we've been talking about the attacks on education going on across the country. And, you know, here in my state of Pennsylvania, you know, one of the things that I've been talking about doing is saving the gem of higher education, which is our state system schools, you know, all across the Commonwealth, these state-owned schools that give working-class kids an opportunity to get an education. But, you know, over the years, we've seen some slash-and-burn cutting. A Democratic governor and a Democratic House, potentially possible, maybe a little increase in funding to help those schools survive. And here to share some thoughts on where things are and maybe where things can go, I've asked Ken Mash to come talk with us. Ken is the president of the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties, APSCUF, APSCUF.org, their website. Ken, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, it's good to be on again.
So, you know, we've been seeing all across the country this slash and burn on education, higher education as well. What are we looking for with the new governor, the new House? What are we hoping for?
Yeah, it really is a nationwide phenomenon, particularly among the states, which have really not kept pace. But it's been particularly true in Pennsylvania, where we've been, you know, in austerity now for probably 10 to 15 years. We've had underfunding. And so, you know, we supported Governor Shapiro, and we were excited. We were a little taken back because in his initial budget, he recommended only a 2% increase, which is an increase, of course. But when you take into account inflation, really, it's not going to make up for all the expenses. So we're in a pretty tough situation. We're really fortunate, I think, because, you know, he said, and we take him at his word, that it's the start of a conversation. And we found actually pretty good bipartisan support so far in the legislature for doing more.
No, I mean, and that's good to hear because, you know, it's been at least a decade now that the state system schools have been under attack. I know there was a plan to, and some action in consolidating some schools. There was some talk of selling some off. It sounded all bad for a while. Are we past that, do you think, or is that still all that stuff still banging around and on the table?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to depend, right? I mean, as it is, the numbers, they just don't add up. Right. And we've done everything. We've consolidated universities. You know, we've had retrenchment of faculty happen. We've had program cuts. And I have to say that I'm very proud of our faculty, our coaches, and because really they've kept it going and they've, you know, made it worth, continued to make it worth the students' money to go there. But you can't keep doing that forever. So, you know, we really are going to need some support, especially, you know, the Board of Governors has been good, and for the last 4 years, they've not had a tuition increase to try and keep the cost down. But when pressed at an appropriations hearing, the chancellor did say, look, with only a 2% increase, there probably has to be a tuition increase.
And again, this is one of those moments where, you know, the value of these schools, they're local, they're reasonably priced for working class kids to have an opportunity at. And we've had this conversation 1,000 times, and it comes down to simple, basic, you know, second grade math. If you're not putting enough money into the system, you're going to have problems, and you're going to have to get that money from somewhere, and it's going to come out of, you know, working class families' pockets, which a lot of folks just can't come up with. And we don't want to continue to saddle the next generation with massive costs. I mean, you threw out a statistic at me years ago that still sticks with me of how funding used to be and how funding is today, and it's staggering.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be that the Commonwealth picked up 2/3 of the cost for students, and we're creeping down below 1/3, maybe even to 1/4 at this point that the state is picking up, and the burden is shifted almost entirely to the students to pay for. And what that means is, you know, that we are last among the states or near the bottom on almost every statistic, including student debt, because students have to raise the money in order to be able to go. I told you a moment ago, I was at a conference, and one of the speakers was from New York. He was talking about the problems that they've been having and getting funding and how they haven't kept up with inflation. And I felt like, well, hold my beer. I got a story to tell you.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, we just in this last year caught up in dollar amount to where we were before Tom Corbett cut our budget 18%. So, you know, that's not at all accounting for inflation. So we just got back in the amount of money that we were getting to 2011. So, you know, that's how really grotesque it is. And like I said, at some point, the numbers don't add up, and then you just have to make a fundamental decision. Is there going to be quality public higher education in Pennsylvania for working class people? And are there going to be engines for social mobility? And that's a choice that's been, you know, it's been being made for now, like I said, 10 or 15 years, that there's either been cuts or we've been flat funded or we've gotten increases that haven't come close to inflation. And you, at some point, like I said, you have to pay the bill.
No, I mean, you know, it just seems that simple. I mean, it's the basic math, and it's something that I've been saying for years. As you know, working class folks, we should want to hold on to this with all that we can, because once it goes away, it never comes back.
Yeah, it's increasing. You know, it's if these colleges start to close, it's not like you automatically open them up again, right? Because there's accreditation processes and things like that. And, you know, and you had mentioned the community that these colleges are in. They're economic engines in their communities, and they are the major employer or second, you know, biggest employer in the counties in which they reside. So, I mean, it really makes a big difference to places like Clarion, Pennsylvania, to Mansfield, Pennsylvania, to Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. Like, these are towns that depend highly on the university. So it's not even just about the students. It's also about the community.
No, it's what I'm we're in this moment where you've got people saying we should have a national divorce and divorce the urban areas from the rural areas and all of this stuff. And you go, have we forgotten that, you know, you need one hand needs the other, that things work in conjunction with other things. And that if you take a hospital or a university out of a community, it's just like taking a factory or anything out of it. It's the jobs lost. It's the economic driver that's lost. It's the community that's lost. And it's something I was talking about, you know, last year as they were, you know, still scheming on how to deal with, you know, consolidating the number of universities down, which I still think was a mistake. I'm curious, your thoughts on that?
On consolidation?
Yeah.
It was a mistake, and I think we're going to be paying for it for some time. It's just, you know, these universities lose their character. There are more courses that have to be taken online instead of in person. It seems really short-sighted, but I have to tell you, you know, at some point you lose patience with people's schemes or their plans. Oh, you just need to do this a little differently.
Yeah.
You just need to do that a little differently. You know, oh, you need to focus more in this area. You need to cut the fat. Like, all right, enough with the schemes. We've been doing that for so long. How's about funding us? You know what? Fund us first properly, and then we'll consider all these ideas that people have. But enough with the ideas. It's, you know, really, we just need the money at this point, because, like I said, at some point, you have to pay the bill.
And it just comes down to that.
And those bills also include my members, right?
Right.
Like that, you know, we are in a contract year, and there has been inflation. You know, you can't keep on firing people, reducing, and really say with a straight face that you're providing quality education. So either you're going to wind up with third, fourth, fifth rate schools, right, where they're not really doing a good job, or you're going to commit to having public higher education.
No, and that's an excellent point. I mean, you know, at the end of this, if you're not producing the best product, you know, people are going to go away with it. It's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I believe there are some, and I'm not going to have you come along with me, but I believe there are some in our state and in our government who would be happy to see the state system privatized and put into the hands of the profiteers and basically ripped away from working people. Because, look, we've been moving in that direction for a very long time. simply because, well, there's money to be made, and I reject that wholeheartedly.
Well, you know, money, markets don't handle every value that we have as a society, and we decided at some point, right, that we wanted to educate people, and really, it's not just about educating students. I'm going a little bit off here, but it's not just about educating students. It's also about the Commonwealth as a whole, the economy of the Commonwealth, because if we're going to be successful in the future, we need an educated population.
Yeah.
If, you know, these people who want to attract these companies, these, you know, big businesses, tech firms and whatever, they're not going to come here unless they have the workforce. We have the workforce. To be able to supply them with people who can do the job. And on top of that, you know, it's a changing society. And it's a little odd that it was okay for people to, you know, when the Commonwealth was picking up the vast majority of their bills, you know, that it was good for them. But now we're in a situation where, oh, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, the students, and either pay it, because we have been in this process of privatizing over this period of time. That's what that is, when the students are paying their own way or getting close to paying their own way. You know, we should be providing this generation the same benefits that were provided to others. And I don't know, I know I grew up in New York, and I went to Queens College, and I had to pay tuition. But, you know, it was certainly very reasonable. You know, the student loans I got were very reasonable and, you know, paid for everything, including books and everything. And I left with a little bit of debt, but it was pretty quickly paid off. But students who graduate today, you know, I have a colleague who just finished, you know, she's a full professor, and she just finished paying off her student debt. So, you know, and she's in, you know, she's in a good position, but, you know, you're really setting people back. You're setting people back for years and years and years. You know, they have to delay getting married, they have to delay starting families, delay buying houses, none of which is good for society or for the economy.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Ken Mash. He's the president of the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties, APSCUF. APSCUF.org is their website if you want to check out more about what they do. I want to get your thoughts on this, because, you know, as tuitions keep going up and funding keeps getting cut, and we were seeing all this consolidation, it seems like a death recipe. And I got to wonder, you know, how has enrollment been? You know, are we losing students because of this? And then faculty as well. I mean, you represent the people who make these universities what they are. Are they looking to find the door, as the writing seems to be on the wall that the folks who run this are more interested in the beans than the soup? So I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, no, we've been losing students, and we've been losing students for some time now. Don't get me wrong. There's been the demographics are such so that there are fewer students graduating high school. So it was predictable that we were going to have, like, almost every college in the Commonwealth had a reduction in the number of students, especially from our peak years. But it's been, you know, it's been especially severe at our universities. And really, if you're going to point to anything, it's going to be the cost again for going. And it's the cost. And if we understand how college gets funded, of course, if you're rich, right, you can afford to pay up front, or most of it up front. If you are if you are of lowest means, then you're going to get a lot of funding, right, to be able to go. But it's really those people in the working class, right, who feel the biggest squeeze, because they're not getting the same degree of funding. They can't afford to go up front, and so it's a lot of money. Now, I've told people, I've told legislators, look, I can still make an argument, and I'm confident to make the argument that getting a baccalaureate, a bachelor's degree, is worth it. For, you know, despite all the rhetoric everybody hears, your lifetime earnings are going to be higher if you have that degree, and you will be better off. But by the same token, I come from a working class family, and I know that if you told my parents that I was going to be set back, you know, with tremendous debt that's going to look like Mount Everest. Like, they would never take on that debt themselves. They would be, you know, extremely hesitant to tell me to go to college, or they might try and discourage me from going to college. I get it. It's a tough call for people. So we're really hurting in that, you know, that niche that we're really supposed to be filling in the Commonwealth with the students who, you know, need something that is just upfront affordable.
Now, let me ask you a last line of questioning, because this is, you know, we're seeing this assault on education from K through 12 on into higher ed, all across the board. You know, what's the value of the state having and controlling a system like the PASHE system? What benefit is it, especially if we're not funding it? But, you know, in the big picture, in the big scheme of things, you know, why should we have such a thing?
Well, you know, you could just look at where we're facing shortages now in nurses and teachers and stuff. That those are the people that we have traditionally been the universities that supply those people to the Commonwealth. But on top of that, again, we're talking about upward mobility, that dream of, you know, your kids having a better life than you had. And, you know, and I don't want to get too conspiratorial here, but it seems to me just a little odd that as the demographics change, that we are now less willing to be able to put up money for students to be able to go.
That's an interesting point. But, you know, because I go back to, you know, you said a moment ago that, you know, in my lifetime, when I was, you know, high school age, that the state picked up 2/3 of it. Now they're picking up about a quarter of it. That's a massive shift. Why did we value education more back then, or even more before that? Why was the value there and not so much now? And I'm struggling to come up with a reasonable answer. One is what you just said. But the other is I keep coming back to this tax cut fetish, this greed that seems to be gripping us, and this idea of the commons and what's good for society seems to be going away. Or is that just too high-minded?
Well, no, I think it's that, right? That we're totally allergic now to any kind of taxes whatsoever, which is, you know, it's hard to explain to people. That's a fairly recent phenomenon that people didn't believe that they should be paying more, and especially that those people at the top shouldn't be paying more, because they always had paid more until these arguments started to be made that it's going to hurt the economy, other kinds of nonsense. You know, that is certainly part of it, but I also think that, you know, it's all the demonizing of academia, you know, the attack on intelligentsia. I mean, just look at what's going on in Florida. And how that appeals to people, and what's going on at their universities where they can't teach certain subjects.
Isn't that crazy? Isn't that absolutely just nuts?
It is nuts, and, you know, on top of probably being a violation of the First Amendment, but on top of that, like, you know, who has a university system where the government tells them what to do? I'll tell you who does, right? We're talking about, you know, China. We're talking about authoritarian countries. That's the kind of places that you wind up with where the government's saying what can and cannot be taught at the university. And I've heard some say, like, oh, the students go there and they get brainwashed, you know, to be liberal. And my response has always been, you know, if that's the case, then we're just doing a terrible job at it, because we're not graduating all these liberals who are out and changing and agreeing stuff. And that's even, of course, false, because, you know, at our universities, we don't get that specialized. We don't get that. We're really bare bones in teaching the basic subjects that people get taught. But there's been anti-teacher, anti-college, that rhetoric, I think, has really been hurtful.
No, just anti-knowledge in general. I mean, smart people are bad. And it's kind of in their defense, some of the smart people have led us astray. You know, trickle-down economics, tax cuts for big corporations, let the wealthy have everything and defund education, especially higher ed. Yeah, that hasn't worked out. Maybe we need to go back the other way. But, Ken, as always, I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back and share some more thoughts. And hopefully this budget gets a little bit better.
My pleasure. It's been fun, Rick.
Thanks so much. Ken Mash, president of APSCUF, the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties, APSCUF.org, the website. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918, and someone was born who would forever change the retail industry in the United States. His name was Sam Walton. Sam Walton opened his first Walmart store in 1962 in Rogers, Arkansas. Just 20 years later, Sam Walton was the richest man in the United States. By 2014, Walmart had grown to the largest private employer in the United States, employing 1.4 million people. The Walmart company is staunchly anti-union. Recently, a campaign has emerged to organize Walmart workers. The campaign started because Walmart employees earn less than those at most other big retail chains. Workers often have to deal with erratic scheduling and part-time status, even when they want more hours. Many of the Walmart workers rely on government assistance just to make ends meet. A study of stores in Wisconsin found on average workers from just one store use nearly $1 million in government aid annually. But there's an effort to change all of that. It's called the organization United for Respect at Walmart, Our Walmart for short. The group has gained media attention by organizing worker protests at stores across the country on Black Friday. The day after Thanksgiving is the busiest shopping day of the year. In 2014, Black Friday protests occurred at 1,600 stores across the nation. Union and community members have joined Walmart workers in pickets and rallies. Interfaith Worker Justice has also been a strong supporter of the campaign. While Walmart has done virtually everything in its power to break the spirit of the Our Walmart members, there is evidence that the will of the workers is working. In early 2015, Walmart announced that it would raise the base wage for part-time workers, proving that there is power in numbers and organized workers can fight and win for a better future. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I want to wrap up with a quick couple of hits. My favorite story of the day comes out of Florida. Again, these charter schools are supposed to be revolutionizing education. Well, one of the better ones in Florida, and look, this is one of the grade A, you know, award-winning charter school down there. Evidently, the head there of the charter school, the principal, evidently got sucked into one of these scams. Evidently, someone posed as Elon Musk. Musk promised to invest in the school if only she would send $100,000 to them of the school's money. The fact that she sent the money and that she had the autonomy to send the money without checking with anyone else makes me wonder how much of this stuff kind of goes on at charter schools across the country that we don't hear about. Because one of my big knocks against charter schools is it's private. It's taxpayers' money. It's your money. But not a lot of oversight. My favorite troll of the day, and I'm going to wrap up with this. Merriam-Webster, the Twitter account for Merriam-Webster, put out a thing. People who subscribe to Merriam-Webster Red will get exclusive access to real definitions. Now, this is a mock of Elon Musk and the blue check mark, which will be the scarlet letter of idiocy after April 1st. But then they tweeted again, it's been brought to our attention that we've been giving everyone real definitions since 1828. Merriam-Webster Red has been discontinued. And someone asked, hey, can I get a red check mark next to my profile? And the dictionary people said, you get the word check mark and a link to the definition, which again, grade A trolling. And part of the thing that I find sometimes fun about the internet, that there are people who can make a good joke. And the folks over there at the dictionary people, They made me laugh today. And we definitely need a little bit of that. I want to hear your thoughts, questions, comments, anything on your mind. Something I said got under your skin. I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.